28. Williamsburg, Virginia, September 28, 1781, 5 a.m. The French have arrived. The sun is rising as the now combined French and American armies numbering 19,000 men begin marching the final 12 miles to the hamlet of Yorktown, where Lord Cornwallis and his army await. It has been a reluctant journey for the Americans. After 6 years, the war has become frustrating and protracted, with seemingly no end in sight. Traveling hundreds of miles to fight a battle in the South so late in the year is an immense hardship, for it means the troops may winter here, far from their families and homes. Their uniforms are threadbare, and Congress is once again short of money, meaning the fighting men do not get paid. If not for French General Rochambeau arranging a loan to ensure their salary 3 weeks ago, the Continental Army would be fighting without compensation. The American lines march smartly forward as the day quickly grows warm and humid, each man in step, muskets on shoulders as Baron von Steuben taught them at Valley Forge. But it is not the Prussian who provides their inspiration, nor the sight of their gallant new French compatriots, or even the rumors that the British may finally be on the verge of defeat. Instead, it is the original soldier in the Continental Army, the general who has led these men since that long-ago winter in Boston. George Washington inspires, cajoles, and commands the respect of one and all. He now inspects the columns astride a tall chestnut horse with a white face and white feet. Wearing his uniform of Virginia blue inspired by his time at Braddock's defeat. Much has changed about Washington since that massacre in 1754. These last 6 years as commander-in-chief have dramatically tested him. The general is just a few months shy of 50 years old, but his brown hair has turned gray. Yet the energy is still there. A few weeks ago, Washington surprised even himself, jumping up and down and waving his handkerchief in joy at the glorious sight of a French vessel in the Chesapeake Bay. After weeks of hesitation, Admiral de Grasse finally realized that his own French army was in danger if he didn't deliver his fleet to Virginia. And so he did. The struggle has been long, but Washington has never wavered in the cause, never once expressed doubt as to whether independence was worth the sacrifice. His home has been attacked, he has endured long separations from Martha, and his sometimes prickly personality has seen some top aides grow weary and request a transfer. But through it all, His Excellency has believed that given the right number of men, the right location, and the right combination of timing and artillery, he would one day defeat the British. Now, General Washington believes that day has come. The British force, numbering 9,000 British, Loyalist, and Hessian soldiers, camps on a bluff overlooking the York River, but that waterway will provide no source of escape. The French fleet now blockades the entire Chesapeake Bay, including the York and James Rivers. It was only yesterday that Admiral de Grasse finally began delivering on his promise of tactical support. Upon receiving the Admiral's missive stating these intentions, General Washington immediately issued orders that the infantry march on Yorktown at first light. It is a landscape the General knows well, for the Deepwater Port was founded on land that once belonged to a direct ancestor, and Washington visited it several times in his youth. Now it is Washington's turn to drape the noose. Upon their arrival, the American and French troops will form an offensive perimeter in a semicircle opposite the British lines. With ground forces in front of the enemy and the river at their backs, Washington will then lay siege, pounding the redcoats with artillery until they surrender. Lord Cornwallis has always had misgivings about Yorktown. "The position is bad," he wrote upon arriving in early August. "I am not easy about my post," he added 2 days later, quietly making plans to flee back to the Carolinas with his army. If there was ever a time to escape, however, that moment has passed. Cornwallis's decision to press the war in Virginia is proving to be a grave error. Now he can only pray that help will arrive before he is forced to surrender. It is almost 3 weeks since British Commander-in-Chief Sir Henry Clinton promised that more soldiers were on the way, stating, "I think the best way to relieve you is to join you as soon as possible, with all the force that can be spared from hence, which is about 4,000 men." "If you cannot relieve me very soon," Cornwallis responded, "you must be prepared to hear the worst." Day one of the Siege of Yorktown begins with George Washington rising from the ground where he has slept the night beneath a mulberry tree. His army is now 1 mile from the British lines. The baggage wagon carrying his tent has not yet arrived at the field of battle, so he happily slept in the open. Even when the tent is pitched, he will prefer the smells of Yorktown, the salt air, autumn leaves, and gunpowder, and will continue sleeping outside on these warm autumn nights. Now that the Americans and French have the British surrounded, the general is eager to begin softening their defenses with artillery fire. But first, he must carefully build the fortifications and gun emplacements that will ensure victory. After a breakfast of soft buckwheat cakes, in deference to his painful mouth, Washington undertakes a personal reconnaissance of the British lines. It is soon clear that the enemy must wage a defensive war, waiting out Washington's offensive from within the confines of the town. Any attempt to break out by attacking into the American lines would be suicide. The general walks within a few hundred yards of the British forward position, taking note of the location and size of each fortification. Yorktown is a broad plain covered in forest and punctuated by creeks and ravines. Cornwallis has constructed an imposing defensive perimeter around the town, encircling Yorktown in protective ditches, earthen mounds, and tall wooden fences composed of thick tree trunks. The forests around the town have been felled to give his army a clear field of fire. The majority of the British and Hessian forces are concealed within Yorktown, along with the few thousand local residents and slaves who are also trapped by Washington's army. 300 yards outside the town, Cornwallis has also built tall earthen forts known as redoubts to keep the Americans at bay. A typical redoubt is capable of holding 100 men and is armed with cannon, and, because it is fabricated by digging a deep, wide ditch and using the earth to build a wall behind it, an attacker must first descend into the ditch, then attempt to scramble up the sloping face of the redoubt. Long, pointed stakes poke outward from each bulwark to further impede progress. The ground in front of the ditch is also lined with felled trees with branches still attached, an entanglement designed to further slow any assault. Cornwallis has had 2 months to prepare. His defensive position is formidable, though Washington's force outnumbers that of the British by more than 2-1. Washington's reconnaissance makes clear what he already knows. A ground attack on Yorktown is not possible. Thus, the general makes plans to build earthworks and trenches of his own. General Rochambeau conceives a design that will run parallel to the British positions, 1,000 yards from Yorktown. The trench will be 10 feet wide and 4 feet deep, with room for 13 artillery batteries. A line of pine boards, a half mile long, is laid on the ground to mark where the trenches will be dug. Hundreds of soldiers are sent into the woods to gather vines and sticks, which are then woven into thousands of baskets. These are filled with stones and dirt and formed into a protective wall to deflect enemy cannonballs. Work parties cut timber for shoring up the trenches, and oxen drag heavy cannon toward the front lines. But the moment has not yet come for these big guns to fire. For a time, General Washington's army is no longer a fighting force, but rather a construction crew. Planning for the digging of the first parallel, as the trench will become known, dominates every aspect of camp life. All the pre-attack preparations are carefully scrutinized and inspected by George Washington. Despite the French Navy's fast approaching deadline for departure, the general realizes that haste could be ruinous. There can be no mistakes. Inside Yorktown, malaria sweeps through the British army, further reducing Cornwallis's beleaguered force. Footnote: the Tidewater region of Virginia, where Yorktown is located, was known for being malarial. The gestation period for malaria is 1 month between the date of the mosquito bite and the onset of the illness. Having been in Yorktown for 2 months, the British had long been exposed to the malarial Anopheles mosquito. The Americans and French had been in the Tidewater region for only a few weeks during the siege of Yorktown and suffered far fewer instances of malaria. However, one such American death was that of John Park Custis, George Washington's 26-year-old stepson. End footnote. With no need for horses inside the tight confines of the town, the animals are slaughtered for food and their butchered corpses thrown down the bluff to rot in the river. The citizens of Yorktown cannot flee and take refuge from the coming bombardment in the bush. Cornwallis himself makes similar preparations, noting the presence of a stone cave along the waterline that will provide protection from American shells. Not that the British are passively awaiting the rebel onslaught. Cornwallis has assured his troops that the Americans lack the big cannon necessary to defeat them, and he launches coordinated artillery attacks of his own. The British open fire on the American positions to stop the construction that will spell their doom. The shelling continues around the clock, at 10-minute intervals. One shot comes so close to Washington and an army chaplain that dirt from the impact coats the reverend's hat. "See here, General," the terrified chaplain complains, eager to flee to safety. "Mr. Evans," Washington replies, "you had better carry that hat home and show it to your wife and children." Day 5, October 3rd. Washington receives the welcome news that Bannister Tarleton's horsemen have been roundly defeated in a skirmish with French cavalry, suffering the death of one officer and 11 dragoons. Tarleton was thrown from his horse in the course of the action, but managed to mount another and gallop to safety. He will not fight again. The conflict took place at Gloucester, on the opposite side of the York River from Yorktown. Tarleton and his men fled back to the safety of the British outpost along the waterfront. However, Washington had the forethought to position French and American troops on that shore. As in Yorktown, these forces hemmed the British in on three sides, with the river at their back. There was no place for Tarleton's cavalry to gallop their horses and little forage with which to feed them. In time, Tarleton would order the slaughter of 1,000 horses rather than let them fall into American hands. Day 8, October 6th. Under the cover of rain and darkness, the digging of the first parallel begins. General Washington makes a great show of symbolically taking a single swing of a pickaxe to mark the beginning of construction. The offensive line is anchored on the right by the river, wheeling in a slow arc to the Hampton Road. 1,500 men swing pickaxes and entrenching tools, working through the night, throwing the dirt up onto the northern shoulder of the trench to form a protective barrier between themselves and the British cannon. Another 2,500 soldiers fan out to protect the diggers. It is George Washington's hope that the rain will muffle the sound of the digging, thus preventing a surprise British artillery barrage to thwart the construction. By sunrise, the trenches are all but complete. The hard work of moving the artillery into place will take 3 more days, but Washington and Rochambeau now have a secure line within easy striking distance of Yorktown. And still, the American guns are silent. Day 11, October 9th, 3 p.m. The trenches are shored up with timber. The 73 cannon, mortars, and howitzers are aimed and loaded, among them the devastating 16 and 24-pound cannon. Stacks of ammunition, more plentiful than any man can remember ever seeing, are stacked and ready to be launched. Finally, it is time to open fire. In yet another symbolic act, George Washington put the match to the first gun, as one American private will remember. The cannonball from Washington's 18-pounder quickly finds its mark, smashing into a house where a British general and 3 officers are eating an early dinner. The barrage is devastating. Within seconds, French and American cannon up and down the line launch round after round. The attack is withering, an inferno of iron death emanating from almost 100 guns. the firing continues almost non-stop for days. There is nowhere for a British soldier to hide. Yorktown itself is being destroyed as cannonballs open enormous holes in homes and businesses. Writing about the trapped citizens of Yorktown, one Hessian soldier will report that many were seriously and fatally wounded by the broken pieces of bombs that were exploding partly in the air, partly on the ground, which broke arms and legs or killed them. Thick dust brought forth by the destruction chokes Yorktown. Rather than man the lines, many British soldiers huddle in basements, sometimes evicting residents to do so. Death comes in many forms. Even as the demoralized British deal with the effects of malaria, a new smallpox epidemic engulfs Yorktown. Also, food is in short supply. It is now the Americans who enjoy a hot meal and a good night's sleep when not on duty. On Cornwallis's orders, the British attempt to fire back, but the nonstop American and French cannon fire is destroying many of their guns. 3,600 rounds per day now fall on Yorktown. So fierce is the Allied attack that the barrels of their artillery pieces glow orange from overheating. On the evening of October 9th, the enemy opened their batteries and have since continued firing without intermission, Lord Cornwallis writes to Clinton in New York. On the night of October 10th, the French army delivers a cruel blow to British hopes. Cannonballs are heated over a flame until red hot, then launched at the few remaining British ships anchored off Yorktown. These vessels represent hope to Cornwallis, the vaunted power of the British Navy on full display, and perhaps an avenue of escape. The French gunners find their mark. The frigate HMS Guadalupe escapes, but not so the Charon, which becomes enwrapped in a torrent of fire, in the words of one American eyewitness, spreading with vivid brightness among the combustible rigging and running with amazing rapidity to the tops of several masts, while all around was thunder and lightning from our cannon and mortars. General Cornwallis feels hope running out. "We have lost about 70 men, and many of our works are seriously damaged," he writes in a desperate plea to General Clinton. "With such works on disadvantageous ground against so powerful an attack, we cannot hope to make a long resistance." Day 13, October 11th. George Washington moves in for the kill. No longer content to bombard the British from the first parallel, he orders General von Steuben forward to dig a second trench. This line, called the second parallel, will be just 350 yards from Yorktown, close enough for the artillery gunners to fire more precisely. Instead of firing cannonballs at an arc to cover the long range, they will be close enough to ricochet them along the ground, smashing artillery pieces and severing arms and legs as they roll. There is a problem, though. Even as the Baron's men work with spades and hoes to dig the new trench, their close proximity to enemy lines makes them easy targets for enemy cannon. In particular, a pair of British redoubts that the Allies have numbered 9 and 10 make the completion of the second parallel impossible. British cannoneers, using withering cannon fire, zero in on von Steuben's construction crews. Progress on the second parallel slows. The tense standoff between American and British forces, many of whom venture out into no man's land to snipe at one another after dark, grows more personal by the day. The anonymous nature of the siege, with its long-distance cannon blasts and passive resistance, is no more. The French fleet is now just days away from sailing for the West Indies. Admiral de Grasse is eager to be away. General Washington knows that he cannot delay the construction of the second parallel for even a day. For this reason, he orders a bold attack on redoubts 9 and 10. The French will attack 9. The task for capturing redoubt 10 will fall to the Americans. Washington has his choice of commanders, and he can think of no better men to lead the assault than Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Hamilton and the Marquis de Lafayette. Day 16, October 14th. General Washington offers quiet encouragement to Alexander Hamilton's 400-man force as it prepares to attack Redoubt 10. Artillery units take aim at the British force within, seeking to soften the target. Lafayette had requested a more seasoned French soldier to lead the way, but Washington personally overruled the Marquis to choose Hamilton. It is 8 p.m. as three rockets light the evening sky. This is the signal to advance. Lieutenant Colonel Hamilton and his men begin the march across the open ground between the first parallel trenches and Redoubt 10. Among his force are African-American soldiers of the 1st Rhode Island Regiment. To Hamilton's left, advancing through the darkness at the same time, is an equally large French force bound for Redoubt 9. Even after the rockets fade away, the night is clear enough to allow the men to see the planets Venus and Jupiter shining brightly. Sappers, armed with axes, move forward to hack away at the thick branches surrounding the British fortifications. Hamilton's men have not loaded their guns, knowing that close-quarter fighting will be more effective with the bayonet. As Hamilton marches his men through no man's land, the sounds of fighting from Redoubt 9 can already be clearly heard. A Hessian sentry sensed the French approach and opened fire. The French are pressing the attack at an enormous loss of life. 96 French officers and enlisted men will die tonight, but Redoubt 9 will be taken. Things went very unmercifully that night, one Frenchman will write. One screamed here, the other there, that for the grace of God we should kill them off completely. The whole redoubt was so full of dead and wounded that one had to walk on top of them. Hamilton orders his old friend Lieutenant Colonel John Lawrence to march around to the backside of Redoubt 10 with a force of 80 men. Hamilton will attack directly from the front with the remainder of the force. Lafayette has remained behind to command his division at the right side of the American lines. This particular redoubt is square, and as the sappers sneak into position to remove obstructions from the perimeter, the British open fire with muskets and grapeshot. The advance unit drops thick bundles of sticks into the dry moat, allowing Hamilton's soldiers to walk over the abyss. These same men then hoist ladders up the side of the redoubt, allowing the American forces to climb up and over and into the thick of the fighting. George Washington watches from a distance, aware that the fate of his siege may well depend upon whether these redoubts are taken. He is still close enough to the action that a cannon shot might take him down. "Sir, you are too much exposed here. Had you not better step a little back?" an aide suggests. "If you are afraid, you have liberty to step back," Washington replies. Meanwhile, Lieutenant Colonel Alexander Hamilton is so eager to prove his bravery that he does not wait for the sappers to finish their work. He orders his men to race up and over the walls with all speed, not wishing to waste a single ounce of momentum. Climbing over the steep defensive walls, knowing that enemy bayonets await on the other side, is a bold act on the part of Hamilton. But his subsequent descent into the chaos of the redoubt confronts him with a more brutal reality. For this is the first time the 24-year-old lieutenant colonel has the chance to kill with his bare hands. Hamilton has fired upon men from a distance as an artillery officer and witnessed death at George Washington's side in many a battle. But now he feels the adrenaline-fueled hyper-awareness that comes from deaths being just a bayonet or musket ball away. As Washington pensively looks on from a distance, Alexander Hamilton and his men swing musket butts and thrust bayonets, ruthlessly hacking and killing the small band of defenders. Cries for mercy mingle with the moans of the dying. There are fewer than 60 British and Hessians defending Redoubt 10, and while they put up a strong fight, they are no match for the superior American forces swarming over the parapets. In those 9 minutes between the start of the attack and the moment Redoubt 10 falls, Alexander Hamilton engages in a rare battlefield emotion. Pity. It is a characteristic the British and Hessians have not shown the Americans in their moments of victory. But as it becomes clear that this battle is won, Hamilton intends to demonstrate that the Americans fight their wars differently. "The killed and wounded of the enemy did not exceed 8, he will specify in his report. Incapable of imitating examples of barbarity and forgetting recent provocations, the soldiery spared every man who ceased to resist. Footnote: the recent provocations to which Hamilton refers is the slaughter of surrendering American soldiers during Benedict Arnold's raid on New London, Connecticut, 6 weeks earlier. Due to the British believing the rebels to be traitors, they sometimes showed little mercy. As one British officer wrote after a battle earlier in the war, "The Hessians and brave Highlanders gave no quarters, and it was a fine sight to see with what alacrity they dispatched the rebels with their bayonets after we had surrounded them so they could not resist." End footnote. But while Hamilton's men produce a minimal number of casualties, the fury of the British and Hessian fighters is such that Hamilton suffers 9 dead from the daring frontal assault. Few cases have exhibited stronger proofs of intrepidity, coolness, and firmness than were shown upon this occasion. Washington will write later approvingly in his journal. Day 19, October 17th. Construction of the second parallel trenches changes everything. The American and French gunners can now demolish targets with ease. Inside Yorktown, the British artillerymen can barely return fire, for their stores of ammunition are almost gone. Today is the 4th anniversary of British General John Burgoyne's surrender at Saratoga, and the Americans sense that another victory is close. Inside Yorktown, the air reeks of rotting flesh. There is not a building left unscarred. There is no hope of escape, and little reason to carry on. Lord Cornwallis has no choice. At 10 o'clock on this Wednesday morning, a drummer can be seen standing atop the parapet separating the British and American forces. The field in front of him is pocked with deep craters, the results of shelling. There has been no attempt to bury the dead during the long siege, and decomposing corpses stretch across the bloody plain. The drummer in his dusty red uniform can be seen but not heard, due to the continuous boom of French and American cannon. He is playing a universally recognized tune for a parley, a ceasefire. The drummer is closely followed by a British officer waving a white flag. Up and down the line, this signal of truce causes the crews of the big guns to halt their fire. The officer approaches the American lines. He is hand-delivering a note from Lord Cornwallis to George Washington, a man the British once refused to acknowledge by rank, believing him their military inferior. "Sir, I propose a cessation of hostilities for 24 hours, and that 2 officers may be appointed by each side to meet at Mr. Moore's house to settle the terms of surrender for the posts of York and Gloucester," the appeal reads. George Washington agrees, but on one issue the general is firm. The surrender will be on his terms, and his terms alone. Day 21, October 19th. It is 2 p.m. General George Washington and General Jean-Baptiste Rochambeau signed the British surrender documents 3 hours ago, putting pen to paper, appropriately enough, inside a blood-stained redoubt. Cornwallis had requested that his army be allowed to sail home to England, but Washington has refused this courtesy, knowing that the British could then replace them with fresh troops. Cornwallis was also denied the dignity of having his troops march out with colors flying, since the British did not extend the same treatment to the Americans after the fall of Charleston. Instead, the British will be prisoners of war. They will be stripped of their weapons and regimental colors. Their disgrace will be complete. Ever mindful that history is made of small, symbolic moments, Washington added a postscript to the surrender agreement in his own handwriting. "Done in the trenches before York, October 19th, 1781. Now all that remains is for Article 3 of the Articles of Capitulation to be enacted. The garrison of York will march out to a place to be appointed in front of the posts at 2 o'clock precisely, with shouldered arms, colors cased, and drums beating a British or German march. They are then to ground their arms and return to their encampments, where they will remain until they are dispatched to the places of their destination. Footnote: The captured British and German troops were assigned to prison camps in Maryland and Virginia. Cornwallis was treated well as a general officer, being granted a parole by George Washington to join the British garrison in New York and eventually allowed to sail home to England. Benedict Arnold was a fellow passenger on that voyage, with both men reaching Portsmouth in January 1782. End footnote. Now, two long lines of soldiers face each other on a country road. On the right side are the French, dazzling in their glistening uniforms and military countenance. Despite their regal bearing, the foreigners have suffered grievously. Two-thirds of the 389 Allied casualties are French. On the left side stand the rebels, many dirty and nearly barefoot. The Americans, though not all in uniform, wore their dress so neat, yet exhibited an erect, soldierly air, and every countenance beamed with satisfaction and joy, an eyewitness reports. At the end of the columns, waiting to receive the official sword of surrender from Cornwallis, Generals Washington and Rochambeau wait on horseback. Admiral de Grasse, the man whose vessels made a British escape by sea impossible, is too sick to attend. Thousands of soldiers and locals have come to see this momentous occasion. But though the French bands played up-tempo marching music during the period of assembly, their instruments are now still. Observers will later remark on the complete silence reigning over what will come to be known as Surrender Field. Soon, the tattoo of British drums announces the arrival of the defeated army. Some 8,000 British troops are about to become prisoners of war. Marching eyes right, focusing on the French while ignoring the Americans, the entirety of Cornwallis's army advances down the road. Their newly issued uniforms are amazingly clean and bright, a supply of new clothing somehow surviving the shelling of Yorktown. The British soldiers do not step with their typical precision. Their faces are haggard and insolent. "Their step was irregular, and their ranks frequently broken," one American later noted. In a display of ego, Lord Cornwallis has chosen not to attend the public surrender personally. In his place on horseback, leading the British column, rides General Charles O'Hara, the British second in command. Upon arriving before Washington and Rochambeau, O'Hara extends his sword to the French general. Rochambeau refuses to accept it, motioning for O'Hara to give the weapon to General Washington. O'Hara does so. But Washington will not tolerate the British insolence. Instead of accepting the sword from O'Hara, he motions to General Benjamin Lincoln, his own second in command. Not incidentally, it was Lincoln who 1 year ago remained in Charleston at the behest of the local populace and endured an embarrassing surrender to the British. Lincoln accepts the sword, and then hands it back, an act of chivalry allowing O'Hara the honor of not leaving the surrender in disgrace. Now it is time for each remaining British and Hessian also to surrender. The scene is deliberately emotional, but it is the final moment of the British march that brings many to tears. For in addition to the 200 cannon and 2,000 swords that Washington has captured, each British soldier must lay down his personal arms. Some cry as they hurl their muskets to the ground in great piles. Others grow angry when the order, "Ground arms," is given. Many of the soldiers manifested a sullen temper, throwing their arms on the pile with violence as if determined to render them useless, one eyewitness later states. But the war is not yet over. The rebels now control almost all of America, but General Clinton and his 17,000-man force are still hunkered down in New York. For once, the man who managed every detail of the war for so many years allows himself to enjoy the moment. His Excellency George Washington immediately writes to inform Congress that Cornwallis has fallen. He then hands the missive to a trusted aide who will ride night and day to deliver the shocking news. The killing of England is almost complete.